Welcome to Grounding, conversations on mental health and Mother Earth. I'm Sarah Aronson. In this series, we work to better understand the emotional experiences we have as we react to the changing climate around us. Today, we're exploring the ways that the younger generation is looking toward and looking forward to their futures on this changing planet. I'll be speaking with Leslie Davenport, a climate-aware therapist and author of All the Feelings Under the Sun and the forthcoming What to Do When Climate Change Scares You. And you're also going to hear from the mother-daughter duo, Gwen Langford and Cecilia Spencer. I've asked Gwen and Cecilia to introduce themselves in their own words.
My name is Gwen Langford, and I was born and raised in Missoula. It's something I have a lot of pride in having. Through my mother's lineage, I'm Salish, so I always say that my family's been here since the beginning of time. We have creation stories that speak to this place. I also have provenance from the other side of the mountains as an A'ani woman or Grovan woman from my paternal lineage. And so I'm deeply connected to this place that we call Montana and have a lot of pride and a lot of privilege for the lineages that I descend from.
I'm Cecilia Spencer, and I'm Gwen's daughter. I get to be really lucky to be a part of that family. And another really cool thing that my family has given me is I'm Salish and Grovan and Klickitat, so from all sides of the mountains, which I think is super cool. And I am a student, a high school student here in Missoula.
Cecilia had a lot to say about the experience of being a teen at this moment. Her perspective was grounding, one that helped us dig into this reality and one that's shared by so many young people.
Ever since I've been super little, I've just constantly heard these horrible things about climate change, like the rainforest is disappearing and there's fires and there's plastic in the ocean and all of these things that just create this stream of like constant negativity. And I think the biggest thing that we can do to combat that, the most important thing that we can do is just to have hope in that. It's almost like the best resistance you can have is just being hopeful and just being kind and staying in connection with each other. I have to keep on hoping, and I have to keep on fighting and speaking and knowing what's important, because I don't have the luxury of getting to act like it's not affecting me or that it's not important, because it affects me every day.
I think as a parent, I feel strongly that one of my jobs is to ground you. In order to work with all that information, that you also have a foundation that's strong that you could come back to in a place that is kind of inviolate, you know, of anything that you'll endure or encounter in the world. You know, again, that you have part of the skill set that you're referring to is that you'll have yourself as a resource. You know, that you can come back to yourself and know your agency. You can come back to yourself and know your divinity. You can come back to yourself and know your gifts.
It's not easy for teens right now, but how adults respond can have a massive impact. Leslie Davenport, author of several books on climate emotion, noted in her book written for therapists that psychology has long confirmed that people don't change their behavior based on data. So, Leslie, can you just start us off with why is climate disruption so hard for humans to engage with psychologically?
Our evolutionary psychology doesn't help us very much with this issue. We're oriented for survival to attend to what's right in front of us. And that's practical as well. I'm really glad that we're opening up the importance of the emotional landscape. You know, this really takes us into the topic that our predominant Western culture really de-emphasizes the importance of emotions. It's sort of not okay to talk about our feelings, and especially with something distressing like climate change. Even to bring it up at family or with colleagues, unless you know they sort of share this and the setting allows for this more vulnerable context, which is not always easy to find, then you sort of get named as, oh, don't be that person who brings this up at the family dinners again.
Gwen and Cecilia spoke at length about how many of the conversations that they have as a family happen around the dinner table too. And while that space in their home is often one of levity and laughter, they don't shy away from really difficult subjects. That can be a tightrope walk for Gwen. allowing her daughters the autonomy they need to advocate for themselves and their world, while also maintaining that they're still young and still require support. But with all this constant exposure to media, how do parents know where the line is around what's too much?
I want to ask you this, which is, how much information or truth about the climate crisis is too much for kids?
I think that's a hard question because on one hand, you don't want to cause trauma, right? Like that's not the goal in life with your children is to traumatize them. But on the other hand, we're living in a day and age where you also have to be real about what we're going through. And you also have to be honest and you also have to prepare your kids because it's not a future problem anymore. It's a current problem. And it's something that we're dealing with now and that we have to tackle now. And so you have to find a way with your children to kindly, and not in a way that's scary, but kindly educate them and make sure that they have the tools and the resources to deal with this situation that we find ourselves in.
Leslie, what are some guidelines to help families know how to talk about this?
It's really understandable that parents want to shy away from the topic out of a sense of wanting to protect their kids. That's what we want to do as parents. How can I shield them? How can I protect them? But what we've found is more true is because kids are learning about it in all kinds of ways, either because you live in an area that has certain impacts already, or they're starting to learn about it in school, or they oversee news stories if the TV's on or on the radio, or they hear something from peers. If it becomes a topic that's sort of taboo, and yet these questions are coming up, these feelings are coming up, but they're left to deal with it on their own, it's much more difficult for kids. So as a general way to start, it's just to raise the topic, invite the topic, and it can be as a question or a natural opening. You know, most schools celebrate Earth Day. So that's like a really easy doorway in. What are you learning? What have you heard about? What are you curious about? If this message is at home, this is a safe place to talk about it, to bring your questions, to bring your feelings. And parents don't have to be experts. And so to open the door, to keep it as an ongoing conversation, to tune into what their questions are. And when they're done for the day or for the moment, you back off and you do other things. But it's something that gets circled back to again and again is the most important part of parenting around the climate change issues.
So parents don't have to be experts. They just need to crack the door open with gentle questions and keep the dialogue ongoing. Leslie gave us some guidelines for how to talk to kids depending on their age and developmental stage, beginning with the youngest.
The real littles, you know, 0 to 5, maybe 6, it varies a lot on the child also in the area. They naturally come in with love and curiosity about the world. They want to know about rainbows, you know, how plants grow, and anything that just continues to build that natural love and connection to nature is building future stewards of the environment, because we all want to protect the things that we love. And if we love the plants and the animals and how fun it is to be outside or to taste a peach or to watch the stars come out and all of those things, that's the best thing that we can do with really young kids.
Admittedly, I want to know about rainbows and how plants grow too, but I understand what Leslie is saying. We can begin by sharing daily awe and wonder with our toddlers and preschoolers. What about elementary age kids?
Once they're 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, they're starting to put the pieces together more. They're starting to pay more attention to news, to books. It might be when things are introduced into the schools. And again, you know, if it's a school where they're starting to present the science without the emotional support, it can be really tough on kids because maybe they are learning that the polar bears aren't going to have the ice they need, or the bees populations are diminishing, which affects our food cycle, and on and on and on. And that's probably one of the most vulnerable ages for these concerns to rise, is if they're starting to get pieces of the news, pieces of the science, without a place to take it, without a way to be involved. So I should say that too with the younger kids, that if we start to teach really simple things about the reciprocity, that nature brings us all these lovely things and we take care of it too. And I'll give you an example that can even be done with a four-year-old, five-year-old. So let's say they're taking a bath or a shower, and the parent might say, okay, in 1 minute, we're going to turn the water off because we're sharing this water with the plants and animals outside. Really simple stuff. And it's literally true. We don't always think of it that way, even as adults, but it's literally true. Or turning off the lights, you know, not that those little actions are going to be make it or break it with the complexities of climate change, but it is teaching engagement and involvement, and that what we do matters, and that, you know, at any age, we can find a way to act in a way that's on behalf of the health of the earth.
Transferring that wonder into care and simple actions, like turning off the lights and running water, is a great place to start with elementary school kids as they begin to put the pieces together. Last but not least, what about teens?
So once 12, 13, 14, early teens, and then into high school, many kids are ready to stand up and speak out. Help them do that. Help give them the outlets, the platforms, the support, the resources. And it's tricky because we don't want to say, okay, you guys are going to solve this. We're passing on the mantle, you know, good luck. But we want to honor their voices, honor their intelligence around this, their energy around it, allow it to be an intergenerational effort, but really make room for their feelings, what they have to say, and their growing leadership.
For teens, we can encourage them to speak up, and we can support them in taking more meaningful actions. Here's how Gwen and Cecilia navigated this in their mother-daughter conversation.
I guess another question that I have for you is, you know, what do you need from me as your mom, or what do you need from the adults right now?
I think the thing that I always come back to and that I feel frustrated about is I feel like they're not doing enough. You hear again and again, like, oh, well, looks like we messed everything up. It's on your generation. And I just want people to do more. I just want people to care more. I just wish everybody could care and have strong opinions and get up and just go join the fight. And I think if I can know that as a 15-year-old girl, all the adults can do that too. Put on your pants, go do it. Do what you can, no matter on what capacity or what level that is. And don't be afraid to get your hands a little dirty. And don't be afraid to make mistakes. Just do what you can and be brave.
Cecilia's charge to adults to be brave, not be afraid to make mistakes, and face this crisis head on is a powerful one. And while it's not the job of our youth to fix these complex problems, I'll say that again, it is not the job of younger generations to fix the problems of our world. We would be well advised to listen closely to them and take their thoughts and suggestions to heart.
One of the things that I hear in you that's so amazing, and it's part of the incredible age that you're at, is how much kinetic energy you have. And I think it's really important to know how you refill your cup. Because when I hear you talking, I know that there's just so much energy and such a strong trajectory. And I think, you know, that's one of the questions I have for you is, you know, what are the ways or the practices that you refill your cup?
I think the most important thing to remember is that you can't give up. Even when it gets hard, even when it's scary, you can't give up because there are so many people who haven't had the chance to live their lives in this place. And so as an adult, you can't give up. You can't stop trying. I haven't had the chance to be where you are. I haven't had the chance to be as old as you are and to have the experiences that you have, and I won't get to unless we solve this problem and we create a world where you don't have to worry about things like carbon emissions constantly.
Living through the climate crisis is stressful for all of us, but it is especially taxing for youth contending with both their futures and their growing bodies and sense of self. I asked Leslie to help us understand how to cushion some of that distress and worry.
I like to describe, for people who are not familiar with it, what's called the window of tolerance or our zone of resilience. And the way to picture this, if I could draw it for you, is like two parallel lines that look like railroad tracks, one above the other. And they expand and get further apart from each other, and they contract and get narrower. And most of the time, we're functioning in between those two lines in our window of tolerance, meaning, yeah, life might be stressful. There's responsibilities, things we have to do, but we're doing it. We're managing to get through our day. But if there's too many stresses or there's such a disruption, and since we're talking about climate, it might mean an evacuation due to a extreme weather event, something like that, it'll push us outside our window of tolerance. And when that happens, literally parts of our brain start to shut down and we get in this very reactive mode. We're not in a very good place to make the best decisions for ourselves and other people. And it can look like one of two different things. We either get really reactive, often there's anger, lashing out, or it's the opposite. We kind of check out, we want to numb out, we can't listen to one more thing, we isolate. And what we can learn to do, given that climate change is going to continue to increase the challenges that we have to deal with, is learn to recognize when we're getting close to one of those edges and how to intervene with our own self-care. I like to point out that to have kind of this rhythm of engagement and replenishment or activity and rest is absolutely in line with nature. You know, we can see it, this rhythm, in all kinds of ways, the rising of the sun, the setting of the sun, and how we respond to those different times of day. There's an ebb and flow to the tides. There's a waxing and a waning to the moon. There's an inhalation and an exhalation to our breath. And yet, again, we get this idea in our culture that we're just supposed to snap on and keep going and keep pressing until we drop. And I think to really reframe the necessity of self-care so that we don't burn out, so that we don't get overwhelmed, so that we can continue to care for the places and people we love and do it well.
So we have to stay within our window of tolerance or zone of resilience in order to resist burnout and ensure we don't become too overwhelmed. If we can be mindful and proactive about those thresholds, we can continue to be caring citizens of the world.
Instead of thinking about the massive obstacle and the mountain that you have to climb, the challenge that you're facing, if you think about what you're fighting for and what you're protecting and who you're protecting, it helps center you back on what's important. And so for me, what's important is that the water stays healthy and that in the summer, we get to breathe clean air, and that if I have children, if anybody I know has children, that they have a healthy, beautiful world that they get to live in, and they don't have to be afraid of losing it. But just having people who will help remind you of what's beautiful and what's important, it's everything. And so I think going back to like the connection to the land, finding those places that you can resource and finding those places that you can go to that will help keep you safe and help ground you and help remind you why we can't let this crisis go unchecked, why we have to keep on working to stop it.
I guess for me, the only solution that I see for some of the climate crisis is based in relationship. There's a lot of mitigation that we can do, and I really appreciate the scientists and folks who are doing mitigation work. I'm deeply engaged in that. But for me, the impetus and the gestures that are made, even in mitigation or resiliency work, are always based in relationship.
So there's this sense of interconnectedness, both in the strife of the climate crisis and in the solution.
There's no way around looking at any part of climate change without understanding that it's what I call intersectional. It's tied into policies, economics, food systems, water systems. And on the one hand, that can seem just huge and increases that sense of overwhelm. But the flip side is that there are lots of ways to get involved and help. We don't all have to do everything. And as each person finds their way, there's this collective elevation.
Throughout conversations for this episode, I heard similar things from Leslie, Gwen, and her daughter Cecilia around the systems that reinforce this pain, which Gwen calls vertical integration, and around the importance of bringing our individual gifts forward to empower the collective. Here's how Cecilia put it.
Everybody has to know their part and know what they're good at, and then use those gifts and use those talents to join the movement and to make change. So you have to know what your purpose is and what you're good at and what you bring to the table. And then you have to honor that gift and you have to fight for it. And sometimes that means just saying, I got this. Just standing and saying, I got this. And there's so much strength, I think, in being able to stand and say, no, I got this. This is my gift. This is what I'm good at.
I appreciate that so much. From an Indigenous lens, it's, again, the nature of being part of a tribe. You know, when I think about reciprocity or a picture of reciprocity, you could think of it as a circle even, in that we're all points on the circle, you know, having breath and knowing in yourself that divinity.
Part of how we experience the climate crisis has to do with our belief systems, our values, and our relationships.
What have we been taught? What do we believe? What are our perceptions of how we relate to other people, to the world around us, that affects our lifestyles and was part of creating this systemic issue? So yes, it comes back to impact us. And we hear more now about things like eco-anxiety, eco-grief. But it's integral in this whole cycle, because if we perceive directly, not just information in our minds, but if we perceive directly the ways we're connected with our environment, that the air we breathe, the water we drink, literally becomes part of our bodies. It sounds so simple, and yet we often function with a sense of a false division, where what we think of the natural world, we treat more as a commodity in an extractive manner, which contributes to this whole cycle.
Gwen and Cecilia spoke at length about how their bodies interact with their ancestral home.
I always say, I think there's something maybe in the water. Again, having a sense of being of this place for as long as my family has been here, I always think of the water that runs through this valley as the same water that runs through my body. So there's a deep connection I have and an affinity with this place because it is actually so aligned with my body. When I get to have a chance to go down by the river, there's an alignment that really makes my posture stand in a way that has more strength, there's more agency. It's really a place of power for me. And it's a place where I'm regenerated and rejuvenated, especially because, again, it's the same places that my ancestors have had footsteps and have had their life for thousands of years.
I just wanted to ask, how can we be stewards of the land and protect it from climate change for future generations? And why is that important?
For me, I'm really thinking in terms of reciprocity and structures that are reciprocal. And so one of the most fundamental parts or tenets of reciprocity is always that whatever privilege you have also creates an obligation. In terms of stewarding the land, I guess part of the privilege of my life, as I mentioned before, I feel strongly because my body and the lineage of my family has literally been on this landscape for so long that I reflect the landscape. The minerals that make up my bones come from the foods and the animals that my family has eaten since the beginning of time in this landscape. The blood and the water that goes through my body emanates from the water on the landscape. My physical body would not exist, and certainly my spiritual body and emotional body wouldn't exist without this landscape. And so the privilege that I have to be alive and to live this incredible life that I have in this place that is so exquisite creates then a critical obligation as well to care for it in a certain way.
Instead of my usual episode recap, I wanted to give Cecilia the final word here on how to move forward. If there's one thing to take away from this episode, listeners, it should be this.
I think another part of having this beautiful landscape and these beautiful gifts and this beautiful planet that we get to live on is Earth has given us so many gifts, right? So much. And right now, we're in a time of crisis where we need to help out. And it's our way of like giving back in a way is just saying, I see that you're struggling. I see that you're having a hard time and I'm here for you. And that's the attitude that we want people to have with us, right? We want them to be able to reach out their hands and to help us when we are in a place of need. And so I think one way that we solve climate change is we do the things that we need to do to save the planet, and we do them in our relationships with each other, knowing that you are holding each other and that you are here for each other. And even when it's hard, and even when it's a little ugly, and even when you're hurting, that you're always there for each other. And I think when we have that attitude with each other and with our fellow humans, we can eventually have that attitude with the earth and with the plants and with the animals and with all the beings that don't have voices, but that really need to be advocated for right now.
That was Cecilia Spencer speaking with her mother, Gwen Lankford. Listeners, we'd be remiss not to honor their contribution to the show. Cecilia and Gwen are the reason our podcast is called Grounding, which was a word we picked up on from listening to their exchange. Thank you, Gwen and Cecilia, for centering this idea for us, for inspiring our way forward as we produced these episodes and thought more deeply about our intentions for its making. Grounding is produced by Jake Birch, Lauren Korn, and me, Sarah Aronson. Theme song by Brian Ramirez and artwork by April Whirl. Engineering by Chris Moyles, mixed by Jake Birch. Special thanks to Michael Marsalek, Noah Epps, Emma Booker, Nick Mott, and Alice Sauter. Grounding is a production of Montana Public Radio. Oh, and one more thing. Do you know what the doggy shake is? It sounds like a hot dance from the 60s, but it's actually an effective exercise to ground you when you're outside of your zone of resilience. We learned about it from Leslie, but couldn't fit it into this episode. To hear that part of our conversation and other bonus materials, head to mtpr.org or look out for more in your podcast feed. And speaking of podcasts, if you've enjoyed listening to the show, please rate it in your app, share it on your socials, and tell your friends about it. It helps us tremendously. Thank you.